Today's program titled 2018 Year in Review. What you need to know about the recesses and developments in trade secrets, non-compete, and computer fraud. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. Copies of the webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to attendees in the following the days of the webinar. At this time, I would like to turn things over to Michael Wexler.
Good morning, and welcome to our 2018 National Year in Review webinar. This morning we will present to you, and that being myself, Robert Milligan, and Joshua Salinas, we'll present to you the top 10 developments and headlines in trade secret non-compete and computer fraud law during the past year. It's been a very interesting year. A lot of things have hit the news with regard to, government activism, state attorney general activism, interesting lawsuits between companies, as well as new statutes that have far-reaching effects on what happens with regard to these topical areas. So we are all clear, this presentation is meant for your informational purposes. We are not providing legal advice. We are not giving you advice to any specific situation, and this is only for purposes of you being more informed with regard to these topical areas. And we strongly encourage you to consult your own attorney should you have any specific legal inquiries. And of course, should you wish to speak to any of us, our information will be available to you at the end of this program, at the end of the PowerPoint. Just to give you some guideposts as to what we're going to go over, some of the things that we'll talk about this morning, the Supreme Court has granted cert to interpret the meaning of confidential or trade secret information with regard to FOIA requests. The Supreme Court has not addressed this issue, and the leading case on this issue is from about 45 years ago. So this is going to be a very far-reaching decision when it comes down, and we'll give you a little more information about what that means briefly in the program. As you mentioned earlier, government agencies are increasing their scrutiny of restrictive covenants. We'll talk about that. We will talk about some notable civil and criminal trade secret cases and some whistleblower protection cases. We'll also discuss some notable cases specifically with regard to restrictive covenants. And as we mentioned a moment ago, we will talk about some new state and federal legislation, both actually enacted and proposed legislation. We'll talk a little bit about new trade secrets law in France, because it is important to be aware of this, especially for folks out there who are multi-international employers. And we'll also talk to you about how blockchain technology is intersecting with trade secrets. And we'll explain a little bit about blockchain. If some of you know about it, great. We'll give you just a couple second primer on what that is. And we'll talk to you as to how that interacts with trade secrets. First thing we'll discuss is the Supreme Court has granted cert in a case which will have very far-reaching consequences. That case, in particular, will potentially provide for all of us some meaning with regard to what the term confidential information means, what trade secret information means from a Supreme Court perspective. This is being done in, specifically the case is Food Marketing Institute versus Argus Leader Media. It can be found at 889 F3rd 914, 8th Circuit, 2018. And as we said, cert has been granted, I believe, January 11th of 2019. With regard to that case, I will give you just a little bit of information about that and why it's so important. As many of you know, the folks who deal with the United States government, folks who deal with state governments, contractual situations, people can put in FOIA requests to various governmental bodies, those are Freedom of Information Acts for those who don't know. They can put requests to get information that may be relevant to a bidding process that's going on, information that could be relevant in a whole bunch of different situations that might reveal potentially bidding and in particular pricing. It could reveal information regarding the specifications for a bid that was put in by any particular participant with regard to, you know, could be bidding in a whole bunch of different areas. It could be defense, it could be food, it could be, you know, supplying cleaning supplies for that matter to the government, it could be anything. And so the Supreme Court is going to look at this issue, and in particular, what we're talking about here is the FOIA Exemption 4. And FOIA Exemption 4, what it does is it protects trade secrets and commercial or financial information obtained from a person that is privileged or confidential. And what that means is that the government doesn't need to disclose that information when they receive a FOIA request. And although the Supreme Court has never addressed this issue, a case, National Parks and Conservation Association versus Morton, a 1974 D.C. Circuit case, adopted a test with regard to a FOIA Exemption 4. And with regard to that, the so-called disclosure that's refused, they adopted a test where if it's determined by the governmental body that the disclosure would impair the government's ability to obtain necessary information in the future or cause substantial harm to a competitive position of the person from whom the information was originally obtained, the request can be denied. And so why is this important? This is important because the National Parks case is an older case. It's about 45 years old. It's a case which is the only guidance that folks have as to what the definition of Exemption 4 means when it comes to confidential information and trade secrets. And so the Supreme Court will address this issue, and when they address it, they will undoubtedly need to define exactly what FOIA Exemption 4 means. So in particular, whereas the common use for trade secrets or commercial financial information is normally thought of in specific ways when you look at case law and you look at dictionary definition, the Supreme Court is going to actually interpret those two terms. And not only will it have far-reaching effects with regard to FOIA requests, but it will undoubtedly create decisions that will be cited to by trade secrets litigators, by non-compete litigators, in a whole slew of areas as to what does confidential information mean, what is a trade secret. So beyond the simple Exemption 4, this will have effects that will affect any of you listening to this webinar in your various areas of practice, because each of these areas is affected by exactly what those items mean. You know, as we know, you can use non-competes to protect confidential information, but what is confidential information? As you know, you can use non-competes to protect trade secrets. What is a trade secret? We know from various state statutes, we know from various case law, but we're going to see what the Supreme Court has to say about this in this FOIA Exemption 4 situation, which will obviously have ramifications far beyond just simply FOIA Section 4. So we'll be watching that decision when it comes down. We'll have a management alert go out. We will be a great resource for that. You'll be able to go to our website, our blog at tradesecretslaw.com, and you'll be able to get up-to-date information. And if you're signed up for our feeds, you will get that right in your mailbox right away as soon as the information comes down. So look forward to that. Next thing we're going to talk about is governmental agencies, as we mentioned moments ago. They are keenly aware of and focused on no poach provisions. In particular, as you may recall, a few years ago, the Justice Department went after the high-tech industry. And they went after high-tech companies that agreed amongst each other not to employ each other's employees. And these companies had agreed to do this because they essentially wanted to protect the confidential information of companies, and basically with handshake deals and other other tools, they just agreed amongst each other, we won't hire your folks, that way you don't have to worry about your confidential information and we don't have to worry about ours. Well, Justice Department felt that that was improper, that it was an antitrust violation, and that it had far-reaching effects with regard to employees. So the Justice Department went after a number of folks, and there were settlements with a number of high-tech companies. And then after that, the plaintiff's bar kicked in, and private causes of action were filed, class action cases on behalf of tech employees, and it's called the high-tech employee mobility class actions. I believe that was the phrase that was used for those cases. And the plaintiff's bar then went after companies that had these handshake deals and otherwise with regard to not hiring each other's employees under the notion that by agreeing not to hire each other's employees, you limited mobility and you thereby limited individuals' abilities to earn greater salaries because you limited mobility and limited where people could go. So not to be left behind, the attorney generals in 10 states over the past year or so have investigated fast food franchisors and various no-poach provisions for the exact same reasons that the Attorney General of the United States was investigating, or the Justice Department, I should say, was investigating the high-tech industry. And so, for example, we saw this past year that in New York, the Attorney General there, Eric Schneiderman, he obtained a settlement between the state of New York and a very large employer to drop non-competes except for high-level executives. And you may recall there have been several cases in the fast food area. For example, the Jimmy John's case. Jimmy John's had non-compete agreements for everyone, right down to the folks that delivered the food to your front door. And so that it's been a hot area for attorney generals looking at these cases, looking at the mobility of employees, looking at ways that they could address these. And so there have been lawsuits, class actions, et cetera, out of that. The other thing that we noticed in the past year is that the Justice Department, the Assistant Attorney General, has indicated, and this may be a new round of going after employers, but they have very clearly indicated that they will continue to go after employers that agree amongst each other not to hire each other's employees. And I say that generically, but there are situations where, of course, that is perfectly reasonable when there are business dealings going on between the companies or due diligence or various types of transactions. There's nothing improper about that. There are lawsuits between employers where the employers, there's a rating situation or there's information that was shared, and there may be an agreement and a settlement that you may get blessed by a court that allows for restrictions between employers. But absent those situations, we know that state attorney generals and the Justice Department are taking a keen look at these particular types of agreements. For the next section, I believe we're turning it over to Robert, and he will handle the next section.
Thank you, Michael. Yes, I'm going to cover the section on notable civil and criminal trade secret cases that we saw in 2018. I think at a high level, what we've seen since the passage of the Defend Trade Secrets Act in 2016 is we're seeing more and more cases coming out of the federal courts interpreting the meaning of the Defend Trade Secrets Act. And just as an announcement, we will be updating our Defend Trade Secrets Act guide in the coming weeks, and it should be available for everyone's use in the next month or so. But what we saw in 2018, the theme, if you look at this, really has to do with Texas, and it has to do with the Fifth Circuit. Some very interesting trade secret cases coming out of that particular area. First, we had a very large jury award in a county close to San Antonio a jury awarded over $700 million in damages to a technology startup, and the case involved a company called House Canary, and it's a data analytics startup, and the allegation was that the defendant, who was related to Quicken Loans, that they had stole proprietary data recipes for home appraisals and comparisons. Similar, but not the same, to what you would see in the Zillow, the real popular website, Zillow. And anyhow, the jury awarded over $700 million, and it was interesting because the plaintiff itself was just a small startup, and one of the particular provisions in the underlying contract between the parties had a provision that stated that the use of the trade secrets on an unlimited basis would only be worth $5 million per year, but the plaintiff was able to have a damages expert testify that the appropriate amount of damages for misappropriation would be in the hundreds of millions of dollars. So a word of warning if you're in you're a defendant in Texas, as particularly in front of a Texas a jury, that things may not always add up as far as the math goes under the in a jury award. Now, most recently in this case, the defendant mounted a vigorous attack on the jury's verdict, and they were most recently denied a new trial. So it looks like the next stage in this particular battle will be at the appellate level. And I'm sure we'll see lots of activity in the case just by the magnitude of the jury verdict involved. The next, on the criminal side, there was, we're continuing to see things with nation states outside the United States going allegedly misappropriating U.S. companies' trade secrets and vice versa. But there was one interesting one that caught our attention in the spring of 2018. A Chinese scientist was sentenced to 121 months in a federal prison for conspiring to steal samples of a variety of rice seeds from a Kansas biopharma research facility. Now, he was convicted on one count of conspiracy to steal trade secrets and one count of conspiracy to commit interstate transportation of stolen property, and then one count of interstate transportation of stolen property. In the underlying trial evidence, it was shown that the defendant acquired without authorization hundreds of rice seeds produced by the plaintiff and stored them at his residence outside of Manhattan, Kansas. According to these allegations, the rice seeds had a wide variety of health research applications and were developed to produce either they're highly valuable to the underlying owner of the rice seeds. Now, the ultimate outcome of this particular case, the acting attorney general noted that Mr. Zhang had betrayed his employer by unlawfully providing its rice seeds to representatives of a Chinese crop institute, and that the underlying sentence demonstrated the significant consequences awaiting those who steal from trade secrets from American companies. So we're noting a general trend of the U.S. Attorney General being more willing to assist companies in pursuing criminal trade secret lawsuits. Next significant case. It's always a very interesting decision issue because there's a disparity across the United States about whether or not companies that assert a trade secret claim and the underlying information may not rise to the level of a trade secret but may be confidential, whether or not you can still pursue that claim or whether that claim would be preempted. Now, the Fifth Circuit provided guidance construing the Louisiana Uniform Trade Secret Act and the preemption provision under that act, and found that you could maintain a separate cause of action for conversion even if the information itself didn't rise to the level of a of a trade secret, the Fifth Circuit found that the Louisiana trade secret statute preempts a civil claim for conversion, but does not preempt a civil claim conversion for confidential information that is not a trade secret, and went on to say that the claim for conversion of trade secret seeks protection of competitively significant information, but under the statute, the statutory language itself, if they were to conclude that there was preemption, that they said that we also conclude that if confidential information that is not a trade secret is nonetheless stolen and used to the unjust benefit of the thief or the detriment of the victim, then a cause of action remains under Louisiana law. And so this is a significant case. There continues to be a split in authority about the scope of trade secret preemption, but at least you can see how the Fifth Circuit is leaning, and certainly in Louisiana, under this case, it looks like the preemption is not as robust as it may be in other jurisdictions. Another significant decision coming out of the Fifth Circuit, again, had to deal with interpreting when a defendant can get their attorney's fees under the Defend Trade Secret Act. And the Fifth Circuit in November of this past year found in a case of first impression under the Defend Trade Secret Act that a dismissal without prejudice of a Defend Trade Secret Act does not support an award of prevailing party attorney's fees. Now, what the court found is they rejected the plaintiff's argument that a prevailing party has a different meaning under the DTSA than other fee statutes because it is modeled after the Uniform Trade Secret Act. The Fifth Circuit pointed out that these decisions do not turn on anything special about trade secret law, but instead rely on the general state attorney's fees law that are more liberal in awarding fees. The court reasoned that the prevailing party status in a federal statute is a question of federal law, and that when Congress repeats a term of art such as prevailing party in a statute like the DTSA, it knows and adopts the cluster of ideas that were attached to each borrowed work in the body of judicial learning, that, and it should be given credit. In addition, for its textual rationale, the Fifth Circuit also concluded that setting uniform rules for numerous fee statutes would be more efficient for the district courts tasked with processing a myriad of fee motions. So in short, the Fifth Circuit noted that the prevailing party status ordinarily requires being ahead when the final whistle blows in a case, not at halftime, and that the court rejected the request for fees under the DTSA. Finally, a case coming out of Texas again was a case in a state court of appeals having to deal with when a plaintiff's attorney's fees were appropriately awarded. And in this particular court, the Texas Court of Appeals affirmed attorney's fee award of approaching over $220,000, where the actual damages that were awarded in the case were only $4,000. And so this case really demonstrates the risk in trade secret cases that the attorney's fees may eclipse the ultimate damages award, but at least according to this court of appeal, it was appropriate under the circumstances. Now, we're also seeing a number of interesting cases coming out dealing with whistleblowers and the interplay between protecting trade secrets, protecting a company's proprietary assets, and also the legitimate interest of employees or third parties reporting suspected wrongdoing, suspected criminal activity. And we saw three cases this past year dealing with these significant issues. It's worth noting that since the DTSA was passed in 2016, there's obviously a provision in the DTSA dealing with whistleblower protections, and it's significant that companies include that, quote, magic language that's required under the DTSA if they want to be able to obtain attorney's fees and exemplary damages under the DTSA if they were successful in a lawsuit suing for misappropriation. But it also underscores the fact that there's a substantive interest in protecting whistleblowers that's obviously exemplified by that language in the Defend Trade Secrets Act. Significant case coming out of the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, where there a federal court threw out claims against an alleged trade secret thief on the basis of the Defend Trade Secrets Act immunity provision for the employee's disclosure of alleged confidential information to attorneys that were representing him in the course of investigating a suspected violation of the law. Now, the case that came before that one was the Unum case, and in that case, the court found that there was that it's up to the employee to show through an affirmative defense that the alleged activity is protected under the DTSA immunity provision. And so, in the particular Christian versus Lynette case, it was in a procedural context of Christian moving to dismiss the counterclaim brought by the employer. And the court granted the employee's motion, reasoning that the employee's disclosure to her attorneys was immunized under the DTSA, that the particular disclosure was made pursuant to a discovery order of the court, and was in the context of a lawsuit regarding violations of employment law, and so that the disclosure to counsel could not be used to allege a continuing misappropriation of the documents that were acquired. And the court also noted in reaching its holding that the company failed to offer any facts suggesting that the employee or counsel intended to use or disclose the trade secrets to anyone other than the defendant to whom the trade secrets belonged. A significant case, and it goes to show you that you need to be very careful in alleging trade secret misappropriation, particularly in those cases where the employee is making the claim that they took the documents to support their underlying employment claims, or their took the documents in connection with a government investigation. Another significant case came out of California, a California Court of Appeal decision in which the court held that the receipt, retention, and dissemination of confidential information by a whistleblower's attorney is protected under the state's anti-SLAPP statute. This particular case we blogged on in May of 2018, and it was a very significant case and protected not just the whistleblower, but the whistleblower's attorney. And that was the significant part, because the lawsuit itself was brought against the attorney who allegedly, wrongfully was in possession of information that was taken from the employer. Now, one decision that we are waiting to hear on, and it's from the Ninth Circuit, it's been fully briefed and fully argued, and it's actually the second time that it's been up to the Ninth Circuit, is the Anheuser-Busch versus Clark decision. And what's at stake in this particular case is that on this round two is that the district court granted an anti-SLAPP on this particular one, the Ninth Circuit reversed the district court and held that the employee sued against the beer company arised out of his constitutionally protected pre-litigation activity, and that the employee had satisfied the first prong. But the Ninth Circuit vacated the order denying the anti-SLAPP motion and remanded the case for the district court to consider that second prong about whether the company could established a probability that it would prevail on its merits. And so then what occurred is that the district court in fact found that the employer could demonstrate a likelihood of success on prevailing on its trade secret claim and breach of contract claims. And the district court rejected the employee's legal defense of whistleblower immunity and litigation privilege. And so it was the denial of the employee's second anti-SLAPP motion that the that the employee appealed to the Ninth Circuit. So that decision could come out at any time, and it's being closely watched as far as the implications of really the issue of, you know, what happens in those factual scenarios where an employee takes company data and then, you know, after the fact or concurrently claims that they took the information to assist them in their own lawsuit or to protect, report, you know, misconduct to the government. In this particular case, the allegation on the employer side is that the information actually had competitive value, was a trade secret, and that it didn't really matter whether they were taking the information to give to an attorney or to the government, that the alleged trade secret shouldn't have been taken without their permission. And we'll obviously have a management alert when that decision is issued, the final decision is issued.
So we've seen a number of notable cases regarding restrictive covenants, which are, I think, important to follow for companies who utilize restrictive covenants in any of these states or may have restrictive covenant agreements with choice of law provisions from these states. The first case came out of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and it extended the reach of the state's highly restrictive non-compete statute to invalidate an employee non-solicitation clause. Under Wisconsin law, post-termination non-competes need to be reasonable to be enforceable. And what constitutes reasonableness, the courts will apply a multi-factor analysis, which includes, one, is the covenant necessary to protect the employer? Two, is the language of that covenant reasonable in time and geographic scope? Is the covenant oppressive or harsh on the employee? And lastly, is the covenant contrary to public policy? In the Manitowoc case, a former a chief engineer had signed an employment agreement with the company, and he agreed not to solicit any employee of the company, regardless of their position or relationship. The Supreme Court held that the Wisconsin Restrictive Covenant Statute, which is usually applied to non-competes, applied to the employee non-solicit as well, because the purpose of the statute was to ensure that any restraint on trade is reasonable, not just direct competition restrictions. And when applying that multi-factor test, the court looked at the first requirement of reasonableness, is this covenant necessary to protect the employer? And in this case, the court found that it was overly broad because it prevented the employee from soliciting any employee of the company, regardless of whether they were a low-level employee, and even those employees that the former employee never interacted with or never even knew who they were. And the court also noted that I believe this company had about 13,000 employees that would have been fall under the scope of this covenant. So the court found that it was overly broad and not enforceable. And so kind of the takeaway from this case is, at least for Wisconsin law, Wisconsin's restrictive covenant statute is likely going to be applied to employee non-solicits and subject to the same reasonableness requirements as non-competes and other non-solicits. The next case came out of the South Dakota Supreme Court, Farm Bureau Life Insurance versus Dolly, and it involved a treatment of a hybrid non-compete non-solicit agreement. There, the defendant Dolly had agreed to work as an insurance agent, a captive agent for Farm Bureau, and had agreed to a restrictive covenant that provided that he would neither sell nor solicit directly or indirectly any insurance or annuity product with respect to any policyholder of Farm Bureau for 18 months following his termination. The South Dakota Restrictive Covenant Statute at issue says that restraints on trade are invalid, except there are a few exceptions. And in this case, there were two potential exceptions that applied to captive insurance agents that the court analyzed. The first exception is that the captive insurance agent may agree to not engage directly or indirectly in the same business or profession as the insurer for no more than 2 years following termination. And the second potential exception was that the captive agent can agree not to solicit any existing customer of the insurer within a specified area for 2 years. The trial court initially granted a TRO in favor of the insurance company, but only as to the non-solicit, not the the restriction on sale, the non-compete. The Farm Bureau ended up appealing, saying no, that they believed that the non-compete, the sale restriction, was also valid as well. And so the South Dakota Supreme Court actually looked at the plain language of the restrictive covenant statute and those exceptions, and although it upheld the non-solicit, it found that the non-compete was not applicable or not did not fall under one of these exceptions because the employee did not agree to abstain from business entirely. And so the court looked at the language that says the agent will not engage directly or indirectly in the same business or profession. And the court found that because he didn't have that kind of broader restriction as provided under the statute, the court was going to refuse to write the word sell into the statute. And so it's kind of an interesting case because you see the court taking this literal kind of reading of the statute where some of the other courts will look at the reasonableness, and in this case you can see that the company actually tried to make a more narrowly tailored covenant, but in this case the court took that kind of restrictive plain reading. The one thing that's also notable about this case is the court left open the issue of whether direct or indirect solicitations are both valid under the statute. And so we expect to see more on this issue in the coming year. The next case we'll briefly go into is Capistran Life Touch. And there the Minnesota Supreme Court determined that a return of property provision was a condition precedent of an employer's receipt of post-employment payments, but ultimately remanded based on the adoption of inequitable forfeiture. That case, it's significant because there's, I think, over $2.5 million on the line. The case is still pending, but it involved a long-term employee who had worked for LifeTouch for over 25 years, I think maybe 28 years, and he had signed a contract that entitled him to some significant residual commissions in exchange for certain restrictive covenants, and the agreement he signed also had a non-disclosure, non-compete, and then also a return of property provision. The return of property provision was significant because it required the immediate return of all company property following termination, and then there was also a forfeiture provision in the contract that said LifeTouch could terminate its those residual payment obligations in the event of a breach. A dispute arose regarding the calculation of those residual commissions, and the employee ended up filing for declaratory relief regarding those calculations. During the case, he actually retired from the company, and then during discovery about 4 months later, ended up producing some documents reflected as he'd retained some company confidential information, some sales records, business data, confidential customer information. And so LifeTouch ended up moving and actually prevailed on summary judgment on that return of property provision, finding that because the employee had breached the return of property provision, they were excused through the forfeiture provision, didn't have to make any further payments. The employee appealed, the Court of Appeal reversed and found that kind of reading all the covenants as a whole, they needed to look at the non-compete with the forfeiture clause, and under Minnesota law, there's some precedence on not having these kind of draconian forfeiture clauses that are disproportionate when you have a kind of overly broad non-compete. And so the court did find that the post-employment compensation was disproportionate to the harm that would be suffered, and also noted that the company actually, received the property, even though it was a few months later, they still got it back. The case went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ultimately concluded that this dispute was a dispute of fact that could not be resolved as a matter of law. The court acknowledged that you could infer from the contract language that the immediate return, kind of the timing of the return of property, was material to the employee's receipt of any post-termination payment, because the company has an interest in preventing the use or disclosure of its information. On the other hand, the court also saw that it could be reasonable to infer that as long as the employee did not disclose or use the information, It wasn't really material to get it as soon as possible because the focus was on him not, actually using it. And so the fact that he did retain it for some time wasn't material because the company ultimately received the property. And so the Supreme Court remanded back down for a determination of, is that timing issue in the return of property material? And if it was, then for the court to analyze, is that kind of draconian remedy of the forfeiture provision proportional to the amount of commission sought by the employee? Next case, I'll just briefly cover the Illinois Federal District Court case that applied the janitor rule. In that case, there was a restrictive covenant that prevented a former employee for 18 months from having any involvement in any business that was in actual competition with his former employer or engaging directly or indirectly in the business of his employer within a 50-mile radius of the office where he worked. The covenant actually restricted the employee from taking any position with another company that was engaged in the same business as the employer, regardless of whether that position was similar to what the employee held or was otherwise competitive with the company. The court found that this was overly broad and too ambiguous because it essentially prevented the employee from working, in any position, including for, a low-level position. And so, and one thing that's important is the court found that even the allegation that the former employee may have held a high-level position that resulted in to being allegedly exposed to the company's confidential strategic business information, the court did not see that was sufficient, that the covenant would otherwise be reasonable. And so the court kind of reiterated that no matter how high level of an employee they may be, there's no protectable business interest that justifies this type of limitless restrictions reflected in the language that in the employee's covenant. And so I think the takeaway with this and some of the other cases is really to ensure that, covenants are being, crafted reasonably and tailored appropriately. And in the last case, Pinnacle came out of the Kentucky Federal District Court. There, it's kind of a classic case of bad facts creating bad law. A federal judge in Kentucky denied a motion to dismiss claims that were brought against attorneys who allegedly counseled employees to breach a non-compete agreement and assisted in setting up a competing business. Should this case, cause lawyers who advise on non-compete issues to lose sleep at night? Probably not. This case is somewhat of an outlier because the defendants there represented both the employer and employees at the same time. Had the defendants only represented the employees, their conduct likely would have been protected by the attorney-client privilege. And we've seen courts throughout the country have consistently barred non-clients from asserting kind of similar aiding and abetting claims against attorneys of those alleged to have breached a fiduciary duty. And so if anything, this case is probably more of a cautionary tale of joint representation for attorneys of both the employer and employees. Oftentimes, the employee and his or her new employer will be parties, will be defendants in non-compete and trade secret misappropriation cases. And so in many instances, when attorneys are representing both, there should be careful consideration when advising one whether some of the legal advice to one client may be just detrimental to the other. And so that, we're going to go over some new state legislation that me and Michael are going to cover that we've seen regarding restrictive covenants.
Thanks, Josh. We'll talk briefly about Massachusetts because that's been certainly a new development that affects anyone that employs folks in Massachusetts, whether you're based in one state or not. If you have folks in Massachusetts, you need to be aware of the new statute that was put into effect October 1st, 2018. And essentially, the statute was designed to protect lower wage earners, students, folks like that, who that legislature, that community felt should not be subject to non-competes. And so on October 1st, the statute went into effect that has several elements to it that we'll discuss briefly. The Massachusetts statute, first of all, specifically applies to non-compete agreements. And so that's an important distinction with regard to other types of agreements, but it's not necessarily clear what that means insofar as a non-solicitation of employees, where essentially it's a non-compete, but it's with regard to specific customers. So there are some application issues that I think as the case law comes out, we'll get a little more definition to that. But right now, the statute only applies to non-compete agreements and not necessarily to other types of agreements. The agreement also excludes certain types of employees and independent contractors. And those certain employees are lower level folks as well as independent contractors are excluded. It provides, as I said earlier, is kind of the basis for the restriction is to protect folks who are lower wage earners, hourly workers, et cetera. The new statute does have within it a 7-day revocation period with regard to severance agreements. It also requires that agreements must be in writing, must be signed by both parties. It also specifically indicates that a person signing agreement has a right to consult with counsel, which many times agreements are plopped on an employee and they don't have an opportunity to review it with an attorney. This specifically provides that there shall be an opportunity for people to consult with an attorney. It's also required in that same vein that the agreement be provided to employees at least 10 days before they're hired, before they start, whichever one is earlier. And it's important to understand that the best course of strategy with that is to, when you send out an offer letter to employees, send with your agreement if that employee is in Massachusetts, and so that you comply with that 10-day requirement. It also has some limitations on the length of non-competes, and they're limited to 1 year, unless, of course, there's been some other violation, like a breach of fiduciary duty or theft of property, company property, which may then allow tacking or adding on to a restriction. The statute also identifies that the protectable interests, that the scope of these agreements are geographic and prescribed activities. What it's trying to do is get at the specific activities, specific restrictions that are permissible, as opposed to having very broad non-competes that is very difficult to define where they apply and what are the activities that are prohibited. The other part of the statute is that consideration. The statute essentially provides for a garden leave, saying that a person who is on a non-compete has to have at least a 50% garden leave, which would be half of their salary potentially, which could be a huge financial decision for businesses. But it also states that it has this, or other mutually agreed upon consideration, which there's no specification as to what that means. So, typically employment was used as a consideration. Here this calls that into question because it specifically doesn't permit continued employment for existing employees. It requires something more. So, you need to look at this, consult with your attorney, and figure out the best plan, but maybe that a signing bonus along with an offer of employment or an extension of employment may be the best route to go here. Because certainly a 50% garden leave can be a daunting task and a daunting financial burden for folks. The other thing that is super important to understand from the statute is that it doesn't permit out-of-state choice of law or venue permissions. And so what that means is that if you're a business based in Illinois, for example, and that's where your headquarters is, and let's say you're incorporated there as well, you want to have an Illinois choice of law and venue provision because you want your agreements uniformly interpreted, which is the Supreme Court's the Supreme Court's decision in Carnival Cruise Lines, which essentially says that a business is entitled to have its agreements interpreted in a uniform manner in a uniform jurisdiction. This tries to eat away at this. This is very similar to the California statute, the 925 Labor Code statute that was passed in 2017 in California, that also says you can't use the out-of-state choice of law or out-of-state venue provision. It's important to understand that, and so you may need to use a provision with regard to an employee based in Massachusetts that specifically provides for Massachusetts law, Massachusetts venue. On the other hand, there's a school of thought that if you look at the Supreme Court's decision in the Atlantic Marine case, which was a follow-up to the Stewart case, in that particular case, it says in particular, it says specifically that choice of venue provisions will be upheld absent exceptional circumstances. And there's been follow-up decisions, one in the Fifth Circuit, the Rolls-Royce case, and a follow-up decision in the Third Circuit, the Helmetica case, in which those courts have upheld the Supreme Court's precedent with regard to choice of venue provisions. So query, what would happen if a person with a Massachusetts employee uses an out-of-state law, out-of-state venue, out-of-state choice of law provision as well, and takes that case and brings that case in that chosen jurisdiction, let's say Illinois, for example, and the case goes up, well, what law gets applied? Say it goes up in federal court, and it goes up to appellate court, and ultimately Supreme Court. Chances Supreme Court hears are low, but what does the appellate court do? The Third and Fifth Circuit, they've already let you know what they'll do. There's a three-part test in the Fifth, there's a four-part test in the Third, but they will follow Atlantic Marine. So the interesting thing will be to see how this plays out, whether Massachusetts will be able to enforce this, as well as whether California will be able to enforce their 925 statute as cases wind up from the district courts. And finally, the Massachusetts provision also provides that a court can reform the provisions of an agreement, and it also allows the court to look at unreasonable restrictions and narrow them down. So that's what's going on in Massachusetts. Then we'll turn back to Josh to go into some other states.
Thanks, Mike. Thank you for those who've been patiently waiting. We have the CLE code, which I'll issue right now. It's a six-digit code, SS8372. That's SS, as in Seyfarth Shaw, 8372. So we're going to quickly touch on some of these other states that have had a new restrictive covenant legislation. We see that Idaho amended its non-compete law to put the burden of establishing irreparable harm when seeking injunctive relief, putting that burden back on employers. Utah just passed a new law this past year that modified its Post-Employment Restrictions Act. It put certain restrictions in that case for broadcasters in the industry and has certain requirements, for example, that the covenant must be in a written agreement, and there's certain requirements for a minimum salary that the former employee must receive. Colorado passed an amendment to its non-compete statutes. Generally in Colorado, it has a prohibition on agreements that restrict the rights of physicians to practice medicine, but it has allowed certain contractual provisions that require a physician to pay damages that arise from his or her competition with, if the damages are reasonably related to the injury suffered by their employer or another contracting party. And so the goal of this amendment is to kind of avoid the interruptions to the continued care of individuals with rare disorders and allowing those physicians to continue to practice treating those certain individuals. And then we've seen in Vermont, New Jersey, and Washington are just some of the states that have some new proposed legislation that'll restrict their restrictive covenants and that we're going to continue to watch. And that, I'll turn it over to Robert, who's going to talk about the expansions of California's restrictive covenant statute, Business Professions Code 16-1600.
Thanks, Josh. And just in interest of time, we'll let the audience know that we will be extending the program an additional 15 minutes. We understand if you can't stay the whole time, but the webinar will be available electronically following the webinar. Some large developments in California, not surprising that Section 16-600 continues to be in the headlines. Very significant for employers doing business in California. We had a recent decision that came out in the AMN healthcare case, which has cast the continued use of non-solicitation of employee covenants post-termination into doubt. Now, there's been a lot of press on this particular decision, and I think that practitioners in this space have differing views on how they view the case, whether it's limited to its facts or whether it's more expansive as far as employers as a whole and whether they should continue to use non-solicitation covenants. In the particular decision that came out in November, the Court of Appeal affirmed a trial court's ruling which invalidated the plaintiff's non-solicitation employee covenant in the non-disclosure agreement, and it actually enjoined the plaintiff from enforcing or attempting to enforce the employee non-solicitation covenant with any of its former employees, and added on top of that, approximately $169,000 in attorney's fees were awarded to the defendant for plaintiffs using that provision and for the defendant having to bring the cross-complaint. So it's a very significant decision for employers who use non-solicitation of employee provisions. And so now in California, there really is a split in authority, and the issue is really ripe for California Supreme Court guidance. In the absence of that guidance, and in absence of another California Court of Appeal decision weighing in, you really have a situation where you do have a split in authorities. Now, you know, the issue with respect to the case and the facts and whether it's limited to the facts is you really need to understand what was that issue. AMN and AYA are competitors in the business of staffing temporary health care professionals, namely providing travel nurses to medical care facilities across the country. And when former employees that were named as individual defendants in the lawsuit and who worked as travel nurse recruiters left AMN for AYA, AMN brought suit against AYA and the former employees, asserting 11 causes of action, including for breach of contract and for trade secret misappropriation. Now, the trial court granted the defendant's motion for summary judgment on all of the plaintiff's claims, as well as the defendant's claims for declaratory relief and unfair competition asserted in their cross-complaint. Notably, the trial court held that under California law, the non-solicitation of employee provisions were unlawful restraints on trade in violation of Business and Professions Code 16600 because they prevented the individual defendants from engaging in their lawful profession and trade, that is, soliciting and recruiting travel nurses on temporary assignments with AMN for at least 1 year post-termination. The court also found that there was no evidence of trade secret misappropriation. In reaching its decision on appeal, the Court of Appeal independently arrived at the same conclusion as the trial court, that the employee non-solicitation provision was void in violation of 16600. It looked to the history of 16600, its broad language, as well as California case law evidencing a strong public policy in favor of employee mobility. The court concluded that the non-solicitation provision clearly restrained the individual defendants from practicing with AYA, their chosen profession, which was recruiting travel nurses on 13-week assignments. Writing for the three-judge panel, the chief judge stated that the trial court was within its discretion to invalidate the provision because unless the contractual restraint fell into one of the statutory exceptions to 16600, it was going to be void. Now, you know, it's important to note one, you know, crucial detail about the case is that there is extensive discussion that the job at issue was recruiting and soliciting, and that the former employees were travel nurse recruiters. And so when they left to join AYA as travel nurse recruiters, their ability to do their job was directly impacted by the non-solicitation covenant. The court rejected the plaintiff's attempt to analogize the case to Loral versus Moyes, which is the case that many employers rely upon in California to justify using non-solicitation of employee covenants. Now, what the Court of Appeals said was that the recruiting role that the case that the employees had in this particular case was much different from the role that the employee had in the Moyes decision, which was a former executive officer. And the court rejected the justification for the employee non-solicitation covenant that was justified in Moyes under a reasonableness or slightly effect approach. And it pointed to the court's in the California Supreme Court decision in Edwards versus Arthur Anderson, which rejected the narrow restraint justification for non-solicitation of customer and non-compete covenants. And the court ultimately determined that notwithstanding whether the reasonableness standard survived, that Moyes was factually distinguishable because the non-solicitation covenant at issue in its case would restrain the individual employees from engaging in their chosen profession, even if the provision was narrow or limited. So employers should take special care in deciding whether or not to use employee non-solicitation covenants on a going forward basis, and really should consult counsel about whether it's a prudent practice going forward. Another significant decision showing the breadth and scope of 16600 came out in an unusual context of college football, a well-covered case dealing with a former USC football coach, which has made its way up and down the Court of Appeal. What the court found in the McNair case was that the show cause penalty was a violation of Business and Professions Code 16600. What the court said was that the show cause penalty was essentially a career terminating sanction because no NCAA member school, including USC, would likely risk the exposure to sanctions that would impact their athletic program and lucrative media-related and athletic program income or status. And it found that the show cause penalty violated Business and Professions Code 16600. And the court said that the restrictive covenants provide a much greater restriction than a single non-compete agreement between an employee and an employer, because his ability to practice his profession as a college football coach has been restricted not only in Los Angeles and California, but in every state in the country. The decision just that demonstrates the extent to which some courts will go to invalid state restraints on employees and promote open competition and employee mobility. Lastly, with respect to no hire provisions in settlement agreements, we had some guidance from the Ninth Circuit in the Golden versus California Emergency Physicians case, and the upshot of that decision, which is the second time that the case has gone up to the Ninth Circuit, is that you need to be very careful, including no rehire provisions in settlement agreements, and make sure that they're narrowly tailored to the specific employer that employed the employee who's entering into the separation agreement. And then finally, the Nuvasis versus Miles decision, a very significant case. The Delaware Chancery Court upheld the Delaware choice of law and Delaware forum selection provision in the employee non-compete agreement, and found that that California public policy was not materially greater in the particular case because the particular employee at issue had counsel in the negotiation of the employee non-compete. And so the court found that Section 925 of the California Labor Code has an exception that makes it okay to have a out-of-state choice of law and out-of-state forum provision with California employees if they are in fact represented by counsel in negotiating those type of provisions. And so the upshot is that the court denied the employee's motion for summary judgment that would have found that the employer's claim for breach of the non-compete violated California law. The next thing that we want to turn to is that there's been some federal legislation that's came up. Last year, there was a movement to ban the use of non-competes nationwide with respect to lower wage workers. Ultimately, that particular legislation, the Workforce Mobility Act, it didn't get any traction. And it was introduced by a group of Democratic lawmakers. More recently, a Republican, Rubio out of Florida, also introduced federal legislation that would ban the non-competes for most non-exempt workers. So this is significant in the sense that you have somebody from the other side of the aisle that's proposing this legislation. It will be interesting to see if there's any bipartisan support that will result in any federal legislation limiting or banning non-competes.
And turning to international legislation, this past July, France adopted a law on trade secret protection. The aim of this new French trade secret law is to offer companies protection for their economic and strategic information. The legislation actually implements the EU Trade Secrets Directive that was enacted by the EU in June, I think, of 2016. And so these improvements to trade secret protections in the EU and France were initially not well received by a lot of people, notably journalists and surprisingly whistleblowers were really opposed to these added protections, viewing the directive as an attempt to otherwise suppress freedom of speech and the right to access information, both which are guaranteed under the European Convention on Human Rights. But fortunately for businesses operating in France, the French Constitutional Council, which is the French Supreme Court, finally issued its decision in July of last year, affirming that the new French trade secret law is compliant with the French Constitution. And in order to comply with the concerns regarding free speech and access to information that was crystallized by the journalists and whistleblowers, the French Parliament had to adjust the legal frame for trade secret protection. And so the French trade secret law provides that in trade secret litigation, secrecy cannot be used as an argument where doing so would jeopardize or suppress freedom of speech. And so this is kind of a similar mechanism for protection for whistleblowers that we've seen in the federal DTSA and then some state trade secret law. Since this new French law came into force, we have not been informed of any specific case law, that kind of interprets or addresses this new law, but it's something definitely that's going to be evolving in the future as soon as French companies begin to take advantage of the new protections afforded to them. And then our last point is on some of the new developments in blockchain technology and the intersection with trade secrets. There was one case that came out of the Southern District of California, which I believe was one of the first trade secret cases involving blockchain technology. And to kind of just give you a background on the blockchain technology, it's kind of this kind of distributed ledger system where information is kind of shared or distributed across multiple computer systems. Many people may already be familiar with cryptocurrency, for example, Bitcoin, where this kind of information about who owns kind of specific rights to this amount of cryptocurrency is kind of distributed and shared between among an entire community. And so the blockchain technology is not the same as Bitcoin, but it's just one, it's kind of the underlying technology for it. But we are going to be having a webinar in our series this upcoming year regarding kind of blockchain technology and trade secrets, so we'll be able to dig a little bit more deeper into some of the advantages, but then the inherent risks of using blockchain to protect trade secrets. But in this case, it's founder Starcoin versus Launch Labs. The court denied a plaintiff's request for a preliminary injunction regarding an idea for crypto collectible cats bearing the likeness of sports athletes and other celebrities. There, the plaintiff had developed this business plan to create a regulated exchange for these secure tokens. that would represent celebrities and that can be bought and sold, not just by investors of those tokens, but by celebrities and fans as well. And I believe these kind of like digital cats that have their own different kind of characteristics been sold, I think, on the markets for tens of thousands of dollars. But the plaintiff in this case reached out to Axiom to discuss a business plan to have kind of these celebrities kind of license or endorse their likenesses on these kind of collectible cats that would bear their image. And so one of the proposed celebrities was Steph Curry, a basketball player for the Golden State Warriors. Axiom did not respond to that kind of business plan solicitation, but one of their affiliates later released a special kind of crypto kitty bearing the likeness of Steph Curry. So the plaintiff thought that the trade secrets were taken, their idea was taken, and brought suit and moved for a preliminary injunction. The court found that the plaintiff was not likely to succeed on the merits for at least four reasons. One, the court did not think the trade secret was particular enough to warrant protection. Two, the trade secret was really a matter of public knowledge, and the court noted that kind of the idea of licensing kind of celebrities to other items was not really that new of an idea. And then to the extent that this Curry Kitty shared anything in common with kind of plaintiff's original ideas, the court noted that it was already developed independently before these trade secrets had been revealed. And I think there was evidence that the defendant had already been in discussions and negotiations with another third party regarding a similar idea before they had received that business plan from plaintiffs. And then the court also raised the issue that they thought that maybe the plaintiff had sued the wrong entity. So perhaps most fatal to the plaintiff's claim was the fact that the idea of celebrities selling these blockchain tokens was already out in the marketplace before this alleged transfer of the trade secrets and business plan took place. And as I mentioned before, there was evidence that the defendant had already been negotiating a similar business idea before the idea was presented. The big takeaway from this is, you know, courts are going to be developing or kind of struggling to deal with this new technology in regards to trade secrets, but at least kind of the traditional classic trade secrets approaches are going to apply. So companies who are developing trade secrets in this industry should remember kind of the key components of trade secret protection, ensuring, you know, we have reasonable efforts to maintain secrecy. The one good thing that the court noted in this case for people who are developing in this industry is the court acknowledged that if something that is generally known in one industry can still be a trade secret in another industry that it's applied to. So the fact that something is previously known in a prior technology may not preclude somebody from later obtaining a trade secret in this new type of technology. And it just reiterates the importance of understanding the kind of technology and business when looking to protect trade secrets. So that's our top 10 developments and trends that we've seen. If you'd like to stay current on some of these issues, we do have our blog, which we regularly stay up to date on these new developments in trade secrets, restrictive covenants, and computer fraud act. And so with that, I see we're out of time. We will be still available to answer any questions. You can reach out to us either by email or phone. And as we previously mentioned, the slide will be recorded. And if you're interested in discussing any more of these topics, feel free to reach out to us. Thank you again for all your time.
This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.